The World is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Many wealthy countries are falling short on their pledges to fund vulnerable countries in their fight against climate change. An exception, tiny Luxembourg.
Fighting climate crisis is the biggest investment opportunity of our time because we will have to change everything.
Why Luxembourg thinks green investing is also smart investing. Also today on the show, Twitter deletes a post from Nigeria's president. Free speech advocates there are not happy about it.
If you're going to do that, then go around, go to every president around Africa. You can't just single out the president of a country and just delete a conversation he's having with his people.
And El Salvador is going all in with Bitcoin, making it legal tender.
It's a real world test of Bitcoin being used as a genuine currency. It does carry an awful lot of risk.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. President Joe Biden made it official.
Today, we're taking a major step that will supercharge the global fight against this pandemic.
He announced the U.S. is donating 500 million Pfizer coronavirus vaccine doses to global vaccination efforts. Biden was speaking in Cornwall, England, ahead of the G7 summit, which starting tomorrow will convene leaders from the world's largest developed economies.
This is about our responsibility, our humanitarian obligation, to save as many lives as we can.
Global vaccine distribution is seen as a key equity issue at the summit. So is funding for climate change. Joining me is the world's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler, for our weekly Big Fix segment. And Carolyn, when it comes to climate change solutions, fixing big is a pretty good way to explain what they're trying to do in England this week, right?
That's right. Prime Minister Boris Johnson, the host of this weekend's meeting, is hoping to broker a climate finance deal at the meeting. That means funding for developing countries to switch to renewable energy and deal with the impacts of climate change by building things like seawalls and strengthening infrastructure. The Times of London is calling what he's proposing a Marshall Plan for climate change, focused on large-scale renewable energy projects across Africa and parts of Asia. And this follows similar calls from the UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, and from developing countries themselves for G7 leaders at this summit to significantly increase this kind of funding.
So we've been hearing calls coming out of the G7 summit for wealthier nations to do more on vaccines for poorer countries. And it seems like in a similar way, there's a call for more funding to deal with climate change.
That's right. They're both seen as matters of equity. Rich countries have done the most to cause global warming. And now the question is, are they going to help the countries that are, you know, dealing with it the most? Richer countries are not on track to meet a promise that they made back in 2009 to mobilize $100 billion of climate finance by last year. Estimates suggest they're about $20 billion behind. And that is only a fraction of, you know, what the UN says these countries will need to deal with the very big impacts of climate change.
This is not a new movement, Carolyn, for financing the fixes to climate change. Why has it risen to the top of the agenda at this G7 meeting in Cornwall?
Because not only is the UK hosting this meeting this weekend, they're also hosting the next big UN climate summit in Glasgow, Scotland in November. Developing countries see this meeting this weekend as the last best chance for richer nations to put this issue to bed, this financing issue, before that meeting. At the summit, you know, they're going to have to work out a bunch of other details like new emissions targets. And Rachel Kite, a former climate negotiator and the dean of the Fletcher School at Tufts University, says, you know, the climate change negotiations are going to get stuck on this issue if it's not resolved ahead of time.
We can't take it off the table before we get to the climate talks in Glasgow if we can't deal with it at the G7. So this is beginning to look like diplomatic ineptitude amongst the rich countries.
Kite says she's hoping that the UK can reach a deal, which would likely be outlined in these communiques that are released at the end of the G7 meetings.
They should be able to just say, this is how we're going to get to 100 billion. It is now met. This is now the commitment for an increased amount. And we are going to get all the other countries to participate in that.
So, Carolyn, what happens if that doesn't happen, if a deal is not reached?
Well, the U.S. and the U.K. have both already said that they're going to double their climate finance over the next 5 years. But if they can't get other countries to join in, it's likely to deepen the rifts between developed and developing countries that have developed and emerged over the years at climate change talks. Salimul Haq is a climate expert in Bangladesh and a veteran negotiator.
If they're going to have any credibility or trust, they're going to have to deliver what they were supposed to have delivered for 2020. And then there's another $100 billion due in 2021. So to me, the issue is credibility of the world's leaders, whether we believe anything they say at all.
The whole Paris climate change deal is built on trust. Very little of it is legally binding. So what comes out of this G7 summit this weekend could impact how climate negotiations unfold in the fall.
The World's Environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler. Thanks very much, Carolyn.
You're welcome, Marco.
So let's now zero in on one small country that's pretty focused on this issue of climate finance, Luxembourg. The world's Anna Kussmer has that story.
If you know anything about Luxembourg, you might know that it's a really small country nestled in between Belgium, France, and Germany.
Luxembourg is a tiny country of about, I don't even think we reach 700,000 inhabitants.
It also has a lot of banking, international finance, and investment funds. Sabina Dury is a financial geographer at the Luxembourg Institute of Socioeconomic Research. She says Luxembourg's banking sector has historically had a sort of shady reputation. It gets called a tax haven a lot.
Dodgy private banking, but also like money laundering and these kind of things.
For years, the government has been trying to rebrand.
They really wanted to get rid of this kind of mixed image they had been associated with.
Part of that has been Luxembourg positioning itself as a center of sustainable finance, funneling money toward investments that help poorer countries build green energy and deal with the impacts of climate change. John Norbu with the Danish NGO CARE says a report his group published found Luxembourg had the best climate plan out of 23 developed countries they looked at.
What we think is very positive with the Luxembourg report is that they are so clearly committed to make sure that their climate finance is so-called new and additional, that it's on top of development assistance.
Luxembourg pledged around $250 million in the next 5 years for climate finance. Beyond that, they're finding new ways to attract private money to address climate change.
Fighting climate crisis is the biggest investment opportunity of our time.
Carol Dieschborg is Luxembourg's Minister of the Environment. She's part of the country's year-old sustainable finance initiative.
We have been working so much with the finance ministry in order to have everyone on board to say, look, we can be on the right side of this and we can be front-running in the domain of sustainable finance, but also on climate finance.
The country set up the world's first green stock exchange, a platform to buy and sell stocks and bonds from vetted, environmentally friendly companies, and funds that use public money to attract greater sums of private money for things like renewable energy projects in the Middle East, land restoration in the Caribbean, and energy efficiency in sub-Saharan Africa. And a government-sponsored climate accelerator that Sigridir Torfadottis helps to manage. The goal, she says,
to support the fund managers in climate finance, the champions for climate finance. Because with strong fund managers, you can develop and manage larger funds.
Funds that pay for electric vehicle projects and businesses that make farming more resilient to climate change. Torfadottis says with many of these finance mechanisms, a relatively small amount of government spending can help attract a lot more money from the private sector.
With 50 million, you can mobilize 500, and therefore you multiply the impact that you will have on the ground.
One of the funds in Luxembourg's accelerator is called Wangara Green Ventures in Ghana.
My name is Ebenezer Arthur. I am the founder and CEO of Wangara Green Ventures.
Arthur's fund does some investments in renewable energy, but they mostly fund businesses that help farmers adapt to extreme weather like heat or drought.
We invest in green, small and growing businesses. So these are businesses that typically require between $50,000 to about $2 million.
Since Arthur joined the accelerator last spring, he says he's been able to get technical and financial support to grow his fund. He says there are a lot of climate investment opportunities in African countries, which means a lot of potential business.
The world is growing to a place where there's going to be demand on people being climate friendly. If you are a major capital center in the world, like Luxembourg, you need to read the writings on the wall.
Luxembourg has read the writing on the wall and hopes to be seen as the global capital of green finance. For The World, I'm Anna Kussmer.
For more of our climate change coverage, head over to theworld.org/bigfix. You'll find stories on how different players, scientists, policymakers, activists, even musicians, are working to tackle the climate crisis. Japan often seems like it lives in a future the rest of us have yet to discover. It's a country on the cutting edge of technology, of medicine, and yet its vaccine rollout has been pretty grim. Only 4% of the population is vaccinated at this point. Consider that next month Japan will be welcoming athletes from across the globe for the Tokyo Olympics. So what happened? The World's Patrick Wynn joins us to explain. How did Japan miss the mark this badly, Patrick?
Yeah, it does defy expectations, doesn't it? There's several reasons, Marco, but here's the big one. Japan's government likes to do things its own way. So from the start, officials wanted Japan's pharmaceutical sector to make their own Japanese vaccines for Japanese people. But all those vaccines are still in testing, and they might not be ready until next year. So that brings them to bringing in outside vaccines. But Japan's bureaucracy is both slow and very demanding when it comes to foreign vaccines, even with something like Pfizer. The system demands clinical trials are conducted in Japan. They won't just say, oh, we trust your clinical trial data. They want to replicate it in Japan. So only recently has the government realized that this is a disaster, gone into panic mode and said, you know, we need Pfizer fast. We need Moderna. We need AstraZeneca. But it took them so long to get those approved for use in Japan that now they're stuck way behind in the supply queue, and they have to wait behind other countries in line.
Is the Japanese public demanding vaccines? I mean, has there been outrage?
Well, yeah, there's been outrage because the Olympics are coming and 80,000 foreigners are coming. There are a lot of Japanese people who are not happy at all. More than 80% don't want the Olympics to happen, according to one poll. And even Olympics officials are being widely criticized. Very sadly, last week, one senior Olympic official committed suicide. And no one's directly attributing that to the turmoil surrounding the Olympics per se, but it certainly intensifies all the stress that the organizers are under. Even the government's top medical advisor, Shigeru Omi, who's sort of like the Dr. Fauci of Japan, he has expressed his doubts about even holding the games next month. He's saying, look, we're under a state of emergency in Tokyo. We probably shouldn't hold an Olympics under a state of emergency, even though that's probably what's going to happen.
Is there any chance, Patrick, the vaccinations could ramp up before the Olympics start?
Ramp up, yes. Enough to get herd immunity, no. So this is a real big problem, especially since a third of Japan's population is older than 65 and thus more vulnerable. The bureaucracy is speeding up, but it's not speeding up fast enough. It's still pretty rigid. In the U.S., you know, you can get vaccinated at a CVS or a grocery store. In Japan, you have to go to a hospital. You can't just do it in a parking lot. So they have all these rules that are slowing things down. It's really not a great situation, and you know, all the government can do now at the Olympics is do a lot of testing of athletes, all 80,000 of them, try to limit spectators, try to maintain NBA-style bubbles. But bottom line, what should be a really joyous occasion, the Olympics, is stirring up a lot of anger among the Japanese public.
Yeah, and if there is an outbreak at the Olympics, that'll completely change the narrative in Japan, and really impossible to say what would happen next.
Absolutely.
The World's Asia correspondent, Patrick Wynn, thanks very much for unpacking this.
Thanks, Marco.
Coming up later in the show, the story of a Canadian doctor from Africa. Last spring, he was among the first in his small town in New Brunswick to be diagnosed with COVID. He got blamed for the community outbreak, was publicly harassed, and had to leave.
This is clearly an example in its consequences how a person of immigrant background was absolutely marginalized and could have lost his life over this because the outrage was that palpable at the time.
Now the doctor wants an apology. You're listening to The World.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.
Nigeria is an African powerhouse, so it was alarming last Friday when the government there announced on Twitter that it had indefinitely suspended Twitter in that country. The move came 2 days after Twitter deleted a controversial tweet that Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari made about a secessionist movement. Joining me now are two Nigerian writers who are concerned about free speech in their country. Adobe Trisha Wobani is an essayist and humorist based in Abuja, the capital. Kola Tubosun is a Nigerian poet and linguist who joins us from Lagos. Thanks to both of you for being with us. Adobe, this is the talk of Nigeria at the moment. Let me start with you. What was your reaction when you heard about the suspension of Twitter there?
Well, the Nigerian government has been over the past few years hinting at regulating social media. So we know they've had for a long time problems with the way social media is run, fake and real and helpful and unhelpful. So the government has expressed that we do have issues with the kind of information that circulates on social media, especially when you have a population that is largely not as educated or as enlightened as you would want them to be. So there are problems definitely with the kind of information circulating on social media. And the government has made it clear for a long time, but this is the first time they've actually taken a step to actually stop a social media platform.
Kola Tubosun, you published your thoughts on this move in Foreign Policy magazine a few days ago. You wrote that Nigeria has slipped back to dictatorship. Those are pretty strong words.
Well, that's the only way I could describe it, because not only were they trying to muzzle Twitter or prevent people from using it, they started talking about criminalizing the use of the platform, which has crossed from just the government regulation into actually the stifling of free speech and the freedom of the press. They were compelling media houses to delete their Twitter handles. Even till now, the Attorney General of the Federation was saying that people could be arrested and tried for using Twitter. So to me, that was just reminiscent of a time in the past when president can just say something through a decree, and Buhari in this case has a reputation for that, and everybody just complies.
Adobe, help us understand the tweet from President Buhari that was deleted. What did it say and what was it referring to?
There's been an uprising in the southeastern part of the country, the home of the Igbo ethnic group. There have been calls for secession by a certain group called IPOB. There have been reports of violence in that area, allegedly by IPOB. So the president tweeted saying, "Remember what happened, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, the civil war of 1967 to 1970, when you tried to secede." So the president said, "Some of us fought in that battle and we know how it ended. Well, if that's what you want, we know the language you understand and we're ready to give it to you." So I know those words were ill-advised, but if the tweet had been better worded, it would have been clear that he was actually addressing this separatist group that even the most evil people do not necessarily uphold as representing them. So really, that was the tweet that generated all the outrage.
Kola, did that tweet generate much controversy in Nigeria before Twitter deleted it?
Yes, it did. And a couple of days later, we saw that the tweet was a paraphrasing of a remark that the president had given on TV. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't even him. It's unlikely that the president uses Twitter himself. Somebody had heard the remarks and then rewrote it on Twitter in that sloppy language that clearly was provocative and controversial. So many people already complained about it, but it was reported, and due to their own rules and regulations, they had to take it off.
Adobe, as you said, President Buhari's tweet was ill-composed, probably by somebody else, not him. Do you think Twitter should have deleted it?
As much as the tweet was ill-advised, I'm not sure that I'm comfortable with some millennial, you know, swiveling on a chair in Silicon Valley, seeing outrage from Nigerians, and he doesn't know how many Nigerians, he doesn't know what section, he doesn't understand the context, and just comes and deletes the tweet of a president of an African country. I think that was also ill-advised.
But restrictions have been placed by social media companies on other presidents for volatile language, notably Donald Trump.
Exactly. But then they don't do it to the Iranian president. Twitter doesn't always delete it. And how can you police this? This is a conversation happening in Nigeria. After the president's tweet was deleted, people started pointing out that separatist group that the president was addressing, never mind that it wasn't clear in his tweet, they tweet the most hateful things, and those comments remain on Twitter. If you're going to do that, then go around, go to every president around Africa, go to every conversation, and then delete. You can't just single out the president of a country and just delete a conversation he's having with his people.
Kola, where do you fall on this?
I mean, I'm not defending Twitter in every of the things they do. I have my own issues with them. But I think in this case, they were responding to an outrage, and the tweet in isolation, it seemed that he was addressing the people of southeastern Nigeria or Nigerian citizens. And so it seemed like a tweet that would definitely deserve to be at the least deleted from the platform. I don't think it's a thing about African or non-African or Silicon Valley young people versus political heads. Twitter is an individual platform. It's a private platform, and it has rules and regulations that have been signed by those who sign up for it. What we should demand is that the rules be equally applied, and I agree with you strongly about that. But the president is not above the law. If he has signed to use a platform, he should definitely abide by the rules.
Marco, taking it beyond Buhari, I don't know of any Nigerian president who would have had his tweet deleted and not done something about it. I'm not saying what they've done is right, no. But the thing is, they have that strong man image to protect. We may not have had Twitter in 1999, but the presidents we've had over the years have responded in certain ways when that image was threatened. And this is what organizations like Twitter need to be aware of, because you're causing more problems by doing these kinds of things. You don't do what you did to Donald Trump, to a Buhari or an Obasanjo or whoever is president of Nigeria, and expect that things will go on as usual.
Why not, though? I mean, shouldn't all presidents be treated with the same level of, you know, censorship or support?
Every single Nigerian president that I've known would have done the same thing or something similar, reacted to show that, you know what, I'm still the strong man on this terrain.
Kola, do you see the path back from this in the same way?
You know, actually, I think what Twitter could have learned probably to employ more people in the region to be able to advise them on what to do. But I don't think that the issue of being able to wade in issues of free speech or threat of violence should be different standards for an American president and a Nigerian president. We claim to run the same system, the presidential system of government, where the president and the judiciary and the legislature are co-equal branches of government. And the president can't just wake up one day and outlaw an app and expect everybody to comply.
Well, he's done it. He's done that it. He's done it.
A government is not supposed to clamp down on the freedom of speech of its citizens, no matter what has caused the problem of the president's ego being bruised by somebody's taking his tweet away. I just want to be sure that whatever we are concluding here doesn't imply that autocratic governments just have the right to do whatever they want, because they can. Yes, they can, but they're not right to do so.
Adobe, it is critically important, don't you think, that the Twitter ban in Nigeria is lifted as soon as possible, right?
I mean, it's helpful because a lot of people make their living from Twitter, but I'm not going to pretend that I feel Twitter is what is running the country. I mean, it's essential, it's important, but I don't want to give the impression that Twitter is what is keeping Nigeria alive and keeping freedom of speech going. No, it's a great thing to have been useful, especially for people like us who are journalists, but Nigeria wouldn't grind to a halt if Twitter disappears, especially because of the numbers of people. We have 200 million people, just about 15.8% on social media, a fraction of that on Twitter. So let's put things in perspective. There are many people in Nigeria right now who are not involved in this conversation, who are not affected by the Twitter ban, and who are absolutely not interested in what is going on. It will be great to be restored, but it doesn't grind the nation to a halt if it's not.
Adobe Tricia Wobani is a writer and essayist based in Abuja, Nigeria's capital. Kola Tubosun is a writer and poet who's been speaking with us from Lagos. Thanks so much to both of you for talking about this Twitter ban in Nigeria.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Every morning we put together our newsletter Top of the World with three top headlines of the day and some stories you might have missed. It's sent to your inbox right in time for your morning coffee so you can start the day informed. You can sign up for Top of the World on our website, theworld.org/newsletters. You're listening to The World. The commander-in-chief says watch out for the cicadas. In parts of Australia, another infestation, not insects, but mice.
They're just splattered all over the roads. Where the wheel tracks run from vehicles, every 30 centimetres or so, there's a squashed dead mouse.
A plague down under. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. After much opposition, it is the end of the road for the Keystone XL pipeline. It would have crossed native lands on its way to delivering oil from Alberta, Canada, to major markets in the U.S. It's a win for Indigenous as well as environmental activists and a huge economic blow to Canada, one of the world's major oil exporters. Construction on the pipeline had already been underway in Alberta, and now taxpayers there are on the hook for more than $1 billion. Anita Elash has been following the pipeline controversy from Toronto and joins me now. How important was this project economically, and what has reaction been so far?
You know, Marco, the oil industry makes up a huge part of the Canadian economy. And for this pipeline, advocates said that it would create nearly 120,000 jobs. So if you add that to the fact that oil prices had collapsed a few years back and that Alberta's economy has really been suffering, you can see that this is an important setback. In spite of that, though, back in January, Joe Biden announced that he was revoking the license. And at that time, Justin Trudeau said that he was really disappointed, but that it was time to move on and that he wanted to focus on areas that Canada and the U.S. agree on. And really, the issue has not, at least in public, come up between them. And, you know, even in Alberta, where this really hits home, the response has been pretty muted. You know, Alberta's government invested $1.3 billion in the project just last spring, so they're now on the hook for that. Premier Jason Kenney said the province would file a lawsuit to try and get that money back, but he still hasn't done that, and it's not really clear that he will.
Last fall, Anita, you reported on this for us and spoke with people in the small town of Oyen in Alberta, which was already experiencing an economic boom from the construction of the pipeline. What is next for Oyen now that the project is canceled?
That doesn't actually mean that the boom is over right away. This is oil country, and they're used to the boom and bust cycle that goes along with that. People in Oyen are not really happy with the decision, but they also say, you know, we're resilient prairie people and something else will come along. It always does. They'd already built about 150 kilometers of pipeline. And just last week, there were nearly 300 workers back in town cleaning things up. The pipeline is going to be buried and maintained just in case somebody needs it, maybe for a new pipeline project. And the workers are also restoring any of the land that was disturbed. So they're going to be in town doing that work at least until this fall.
Indigenous groups and environmentalists in the United States staged major protests, as we will remember, against the Keystone XL pipeline project. What are you hearing from those same groups in Canada?
Well, environmentalists and a lot of Indigenous groups are thrilled with the decision, but there are also other Indigenous groups who really are not that happy. There's one in particular, the National Coalition of Chiefs, which describes it as a kick in the teeth for First Nations people. And they say now that the project is dead, what that does is it entrenches poverty for them. It means fewer jobs for Indigenous people and more long-term unemployment.
So, Anita, what's next for the oil industry in Canada, especially when it comes to other pipeline projects?
The industry still has lots of other ways to ship its product, and there are also other pipelines under construction.
So it looks like XL is over, but other pipelines may still be in the offing. Reporter Anita Elash in Toronto, thanks very much for this update.
You're welcome, Marco.
Last year, when coronavirus outbreaks first swept across the globe, there was confusion followed by a lot of scapegoating. People of Asian backgrounds were unfairly blamed and ostracized. So were some medical professionals. That's what happened to a doctor in Canada, originally from the Democratic Republic of Congo. The world's Rupa Shenoy has our story.
Last May, as the province of New Brunswick went into one of the strictest lockdowns in Canada, a family physician named Jean-Robert Nogala got a call to come pick up his four-year-old daughter in Montreal.
She's so beautiful. I love her very much.
Her mother, his ex-wife, had to attend a family funeral in Africa. Nogala contacted local police, and they told him it was okay to travel. So he drove the 7 hours to Montreal, spent the night at his brother's place, collected his daughter, and returned home. Health officials advised him that, like other doctors traveling at the time, he could go back to seeing patients. He didn't have to spend time in quarantine, since he didn't believe he'd been exposed. But soon, one of Nogala's patients tested positive for the coronavirus. On May 27, 2020, he tested positive, too, although he had no symptoms. He went into quarantine. Later that same day, the premier of New Brunswick, Blaine Higgs, spoke about the outbreak at a press conference and mentioned patient zero.
This is a healthcare worker who saw multiple patients over a two-week period following their return to New Brunswick. We are still contact tracing, but we know this zone is currently at a higher risk due to the actions of one irresponsible individual.
The premier didn't say Jean-Robert Nogala's name, but that leaked online. And with a little sleuthing, people found Nogala's address and photo. Within hours, his whole life changed.
I was treated like a criminal, but I did nothing wrong. I was doing my job.
His employer suspended him without pay. People assailed him online and waited outside his home, delivering death threats and racist taunts, telling him to go back to Africa. He had to ask for police protection. At the same time, authorities opened a criminal investigation against him for failing to isolate. Joël Etienne, Nugola's attorney, says random people falsely accused him of breaking quarantine.
People would be congregating in places of commerce, and they would see a person of color, and they would call the authorities and say, oh, the good doctor is not quarantining. You need to run the police to his house. And the police would show up and accuse him of non-self-quarantining.
In all, 41 people were infected in that outbreak, and 2 people died. But doctors rallied to Nugola's defense. In September, 1,500 physicians signed a letter blaming systemic racism for his treatment.
This is clearly an example in its consequences how a person of immigrant background, a person who is African-Canadian, was absolutely marginalized, penalized, and could have lost his life over this because the outrage was that palpable at the time.
When a mayor in Quebec heard Nugola's story, he invited him to come live and work there. Nugola took him up on the offer. His trial was supposed to begin this month, and if found guilty, he faced as much as $8,000 in fines. But last week, prosecutors dropped the charges, saying they'd been provided with evidence that showed they had little chance to convict.
Now I'm not a criminal. I can continue life like a human being.
It's not completely over for Nugola. There's still something he wants, and that's an apology from Premier Blaine Higgs.
The apology means the beginning of the healing. I cannot change the past, but I have to prepare myself for the future.
So far, Higgs has refused the invitation to apologize.
If I recall, at the time, it was when we had our first fatality in the long journey of COVID, and we needed to ensure that everyone was following the rules carefully and taking every case and every situation seriously.
Higgs said it's unfortunate if Nugola took his comments personally. Nugola's attorneys say they're considering suing for damages. For the world, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
Across many parts of the eastern U.S., cicadas emerging from their 17-year slumber have been creating a racket. Trillions of them up and down the eastern seaboard. It is biblical in scale. On the other side of the globe, Australians may be able to relate. For months, parts of eastern Australia have been overrun by an infestation, also at plague level, of mice. Millions of them squirming and squeaking, courtesy of a video there posted by the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. Steve Henry is the leading mouse expert at CSIRO. That's the Australian government scientific research agency. Steve joins us from Canberra. Steve, if you're in a part of New South Wales that's facing this problem, we just heard them. Give us a sense of what millions of mice looks like.
They're literally everywhere. So there's not just the economic damage that they cause to crops and fodder storages and grain storages. There's the fact that they're actually everywhere in people's houses. The smell becomes almost overpowering of both live mice, but also dead mice that have gone into roof spaces and wall cavities to die. It's a really challenging situation for those rural communities.
And what does this many mice smell like?
When I went to pay for fuel in a small township called Gilgandra in central New South Wales, you fill up the vehicle with fuel, walk into pay, and you're struck straight away by the smell of dead mice, obviously in the roof space and, wow, and through that area. In areas where they're really thick, they're just splattered all over the roads. Where the wheel tracks run from vehicles, every 30 centimetres or so, there's a squashed dead mouse.
That's unbelievable. So you mentioned the destruction these mice have caused. What have you seen?
We see things like total crop destruction. So they've eaten so much of the summer sorghum crop in far northern New South Wales that farmers just gave up on it and ploughed it back into the ground. If farmers were lucky enough to get through to harvest, some of those loads of grain were being rejected because of the presence of mouse feces in the samples. So that's another challenge there. I know of one haystack comprising 3,000 bales of hay that was just set on fire, and that's a loss of $120,000 right there.
And yet this is not the first infestation of mice on the scale before in Australia, is it?
No, they come along about every 10 years, typically after a run of dry years. Conditions just get so favourable for mouse breeding, so they become favourable for growing crops. That puts a lot of food in the system, and then mice breed to really high numbers really fast. And this year we've had a mild, moist summer, so they've continued to breed through the summer and right through the autumn.
This is one of the worst infestations, though, in recent memory. What options are there to combat this mouse problem?
What we've been focusing on is protecting the winter crop as it gets sown in the autumn. And farmers are allowed to use a product called zinc phosphide. It's a toxin. I'm loath to call a toxin a good toxin, but it's one where there's a very low chance of secondary poisoning to other animals. Now, we've recently done some research that said that we needed to increase the strength of zinc phosphide for it to be effective, and we've just got regulatory approval for that to be used. And then in the future, what we're saying to farmers is continue to monitor mice through the winter, and at the first sign of any damage in their crops in the spring, then they need to be prepared to bait again to reduce the impact.
So, Steve, are there any signs that this mouse infestation is letting up? How long could it last?
Mouse plagues end very suddenly, and what drives the end of a mouse plague is not well understood. Literally, you know, farmers will call me and say, "What's happened to all my mice? They've just disappeared." And we think what happens is as mouse numbers get really high, you get a higher level of interaction, and that facilitates the spread of diseases. Now, at the same time that that's happening, it's coinciding with them starting to run low on food. They start to turn on the sick and weak ones and eat them. They're always eating baby mice because they're a great source of protein, and the world's not a very nice place, so they're preying on baby mice all the time. And so all of those things together lead to the population dramatically crashing away. Now, we're hopeful that that will happen, but it's very difficult to predict. And so what we're counselling is that farmers need to be vigilant through the wintertime, be ready to deal with mice again next spring if they start to see signs of damage.
Right. And just a reminder for our listeners that next spring in Australia will be, that starts in October or so, right?
Yes, that's right, September, October.
Steve Henry is a research officer and mouse expert at CSIRO, the Australian Government Scientific Research Agency. Steve, thank you very much for your time.
It's a pleasure.
Some crazy Australian mice videos on TikTok. Lots of goofing around and crazy dance moves there, too. In Malaysia, a teenager is using TikTok for activism. She and other students say there's a culture of sexual harassment and misogyny in Malaysia's classrooms. And TikTok is a tool they've turned to spark a nationwide conversation and take on Malaysia's schools. Reporter Ashley Westerman has our story.
So I just came home from school, and today in class, we were learning PJK with this male teacher.
On April 23rd, 17-year-old Aine Husniza posted this video to TikTok, calling out her teacher for cracking a joke about rape during class.
And then he said, guess what?
If you want to rape someone, make sure they are above 18, said the teacher. The video has been viewed more than 1.8 million times and started a very frank conversation about how women and girls are treated at school in Malaysia, a diverse Muslim-majority country of nearly 40 million people. Aine's hashtag, Make School a Safer Place, started trending soon after, and in May, it led to one of the largest student protests in Malaysian history. But more than a month later, Aine, who lives outside of the capital, Kuala Lumpur, sounds a bit deflated.
Honestly, I feel really tired, and I'm somewhat disappointed because
she's been through a lot. Right now, after posting the video, Aine was bombarded with hateful messages from netizens. She's also been body shamed and has even received rape threats from fellow students.
Most of my classmates turned their backs towards me. They said that I was just being over about it, when in fact they themselves also went through the same thing I did.
She's also had to move schools after her old public school wanted to expel her for not attending because she feared for her safety.
Most of the schools are trying to protect the abusers rather than the victims. I think that says a lot about our state of schools right now.
Meanwhile, there's been no action taken in the two cases Aine and her family have filed, one against the gym teacher and another against a fellow student who threatened to rape her.
Sadly, unfortunately, this is not surprising.
That's Gayatri Balakrishnan with the Malaysian-based NGO Women's Aid Organization.
In Malaysia, the culture is still very much patriarchal culture. Rape culture is extremely prevalent in Malaysia. And whenever it comes to a situation of sexual violence or sexual abuse, a lot of people victim shame and blame the survivors.
Balikrishnan says this toxic culture is not new, nor is it specific to any kind or level of school in Malaysia, a place where teachers are highly respected. Statistics regarding abuse toward girls in schools are hard to come by. The government doesn't really keep them, she says, so it falls to NGOs like hers to try, but that data is often incomplete. Balikrishnan says this leads people to believe there's not a problem.
The biggest thing that we need the government agencies to do is to listen to the students. You know, it's just something simple as them supporting AIIMS movement in a public platform.
Still, Balikrishnan says this is a watershed moment for Malaysia. It's also inspired people like advocate Puturi Nuraina Balkis, the co-founder of Save the Schools Malaysia, an online platform where people can share their experiences of school-based harassment and violence.
The stories came in from every single corner of the country. People everywhere are talking about it.
There's some 440 stories shared on the Instagram account, and there's hundreds more in the pipeline, says Bakis. Stories about students enduring verbal assaults, inappropriate gestures, groping, and even period spot checks by school administration. Balkis says this movement has given students an opportunity to speak out like never before.
If we keep on producing students who are only book smart, but they are not enriched enough, that what are the precedents that we are setting for the future Malaysia?
Ain says despite the setbacks, she does not regret posting that first video or any subsequent videos to TikTok.
It really boils down towards like, I'm a 17-year-old. I shouldn't be thinking of what a country should do for its students.
And while Ain is happy to offer up some changes she wishes could be made, like better sex education in schools and for students to be empowered to recognize when they're being victimized, what she really wants to know is, where are the adults in the room?
I say something is wrong here. So you should, adults should really think of the solution on how to make it better.
For The World, I'm Ashley Westerman in Manila.
If you're like me, Bitcoin is just a conceptual thing, something that techies use, not the rest of us. But if you live in El Salvador, it's something many people will soon use. Earlier this week, El Salvador became the first country in the world to adopt the cryptocurrency as legal tender. The new law goes into effect in about 3 months. From then on, Bitcoin will be used to do everything from paying taxes to buying groceries in El Salvador. To unpack the mystery of Bitcoin, I'm joined by Neil Wilson. He's the chief market analyst for Markets.com in London. Let's start with the very basics, Neil. Remind us what Bitcoin is.
Bitcoin is a decentralized cryptocurrency. So it's probably the most famous. It's the original. And it's based on a decentralized system that doesn't involve central banks. It has traditionally been sort of touted as a currency, but of late we've seen it increasingly being treated as sort of an investable asset, so more like a security, like a stock or a bond. So it's undergoing quite an evolution, even as we speak.
So El Salvador's president, Nayib Bukele, has been a strong advocate for Bitcoin. But how did this new law come together and eventually pass El Salvador's Congress?
The president of El Salvador has noted that he's maybe one for making a grand gesture, a flashy sort of gesture. He recently sacked 5 Supreme Court judges. So I think in El Salvador politically, it's not as crystal clear as it otherwise might be. There's clearly a bit of muddiness here. I think there may be a couple of reasons for going down this route. On the one hand, you could say it's an authoritarian leader seeking attention. There's another argument that says in a highly dollarized economy, like El Salvador is, it basically uses the US dollar, that going down this route for Bitcoin is a way for the country to extricate itself from the dollar system. Now, it's also got a $1 billion IMF funding package that it's trying to get from the IMF. And that's not been going so well since the sacking of these judges. So there's a third argument that maybe suggests that they want to generate capital inflows into the country using Bitcoin.
Beyond these big economic considerations, Neil, what is President Bukele saying specifically as to the benefits of integrating Bitcoin into El Salvador?
Yeah, so I mean, the law itself, it makes Bitcoin legal tender. So any business, shop or other company, they must accept it as a currency. So the idea, I think, is to, as I say, there's a weaning off of the dollar whilst generating inflows of capital. And we've got to remember that El Salvador has I think 20% of its GDP comes from remittances from expatriates who are living, I think, chiefly in the United States, and they send money back home. Bitcoin is seen as maybe an easier way for people to do that. They can transfer the money back to El Salvador using Bitcoin wallets, and making that relatively straightforward. But there are, of course, lots of problems with this plan, lots of potential risks. And, you know, at a very basic level, you are exposing all consumers and businesses to a high degree of exchange rate volatility, as we've seen the way Bitcoin moves around, that gets to the point where you would think that the Bitcoin itself is secondary to the purpose of generating inflows into the country.
What are the risks here? I mean, we know Bitcoin is subject to wild fluctuations in its value. And if I'm in El Salvador, I'd be getting a little nervous, for example, about my retirement savings. How concerned are you about the Bitcoin risks and Salvadorans getting fully informed about them?
So one of the arguments, or certainly one of the reasons put forward by the government for going down this road, is to enable something like 70% of the country are unbanked. So it enables them to have access to financial services. The risk of that, of course, is that if you are exposed to Bitcoin, it's very volatile for starters. So the money in your account could be worth half what it was the day before quite easily. We saw a big crash in Bitcoin just a couple of weeks ago, where it crashed about 50% in a couple of days. So it's a highly volatile asset, and it's not like the dollar. So it does create problems. And I think if people do use the Bitcoin to transact, then I would be very surprised if merchants weren't instantly transferring it into dollars. So it's used as a sort of vehicle for the dollar rather than anything else. But at the same time, of course, there'll be lots of businesses, individuals, and the government in El Salvador, which will be banking on Bitcoin ultimately going up in value. And therefore, they might choose to keep a portion of Bitcoin as a hedge against what's likely to be quite substantial inflation. Because as this money comes in, it's equivalent to sort of increase in the country's money supply. And that would boost economic activity, but it's also going to drive inflation and potentially interest rates higher as well.
So El Salvador is the first country to do this. Do you worry about El Salvador becoming a kind of Bitcoin Wild West? And what would that look like?
Yeah, I mean, I think, on a positive front for El Salvador, for the world, it's a real world test of Bitcoin being used as a genuine currency. I would worry. I'm not a particular crypto fan or believer. So coming from my point of view, it does carry an awful lot of risk. I think that a couple of years down the line, if Bitcoin is worth 10 times what it is now, then we'll all be saying El Salvador has pulled the blinder and done the right thing. But if it's collapsed, or there's been a significant amount of volatility, which we can expect, then lots of individuals will have lost out. They will have lost money along the way, and that could make the country poorer.
Neil Wilson is the chief market analyst for Markets.com, speaking with us about El Salvador, the first country to adopt Bitcoin as legal tender. Neil, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Finally today, when the G7 leaders gathered in Cornwall at Carbis Bay, look up the coast, they can actually see themselves. If they were to stroll down the beach a ways, they'd realize that what they're seeing are not terribly flattering likenesses. Mount Recyclemore. Yes, it is a riff on Mount Rushmore. It's a massive art installation positioned on a clifftop. It features the leaders of the G7 made entirely out of e-waste. Old computers, circuit boards, discarded cell phones, TV screens, even electronic piano keyboards. Each leader's face is about 4 by 10 feet large. It's all to remind them that e-waste is a massive global problem. According to the UN, more than 53 million tons of e-waste was generated worldwide in 2019. The stuff goes into landfills and releases toxins into the soil and water. Different artists worked on the 7 faces of the world leaders. Some of the artists apparently were eager to be the one to craft Joe Biden's nose or Boris Johnson's hair. But as the lead artist, Joe Rush, explained to Bloomberg News, the point was not to mock some of the most powerful people in the world, it's to get them to do something about a serious global problem.
We have to deal with it. As a human race, we have to deal with it, not as nations, where one nation is pushing it off to another nation to get rid of, you know, and polluting all their land with it. This is why it's the G7 leaders, this is why it's here, is to get them all talking to each other and just say, let's sort this out as a human race.
No word on whether the installation has sparked that high-level conversation yet, Mount Recycle More will be up for a few days longer. On Sunday, it'll be dismantled and moved to Manchester in northern England, where the public will be able to view it. Aside from the message, organizers of Mount Recycle More have partnered with the global waste management charity, WasteAid. For the rest of June, they're giving WasteAid about $1.50 for every piece of consumer tech that customers donate. You can see the big, brilliant Mount Recycle More on our Instagram page. We are at theworld.org/Instagram. That'll do it for us today from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you tomorrow. From PR.